You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll meet a 14-year-old Wisconsinite who spends her time at the racetrack or in the garage. A Chippewa Falls resident shares her run as a Midwest mod race car driver. Now, the Senate Judiciary Committee released a report last week providing evidence that President Trump was directly involved in intervening with the Justice Department with the goal of overturning the election and staying in office. The report, titled Subverting Justice, How the Former President and His Allies Pressured DOJ to Overturn the 2020 Election, details Trump's attempts to convince members of the Justice Department to find evidence of fraud where there was none and overturn the election results. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you followed this Senate report on the former president's attempts to, in effect, overturn the election? Do you want to see action taken, more investigations? Are you following the House January 6th committee? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions about all of this. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Paul Nolette is an associate professor and chair of the political science department at Marquette University. He's the author of Federalism on Trial, State Attorneys General, and National Policymaking in Contemporary America. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, this Senate report, now I should say this is the part written by the Democrats on the committee. Republicans came to some different conclusions. What stood out to you in the evidence they presented when it came to the president and his staff reaching out to the Justice Department to take action on the election?
I think the big thing that really comes out of this report is that despite quite a bit of lack of cooperation between some key individuals and this committee, that the committee was able to compile a lot of evidence suggesting that there was some real pressure coming from the White House on the Department of Justice to take action for alleged voter fraud. That was allegedly occurring, according to the White House, in a number of states, and that it really raises some real questions about exactly how far the White House was willing to go in trying to direct the Department of Justice to, you know, to bend to its will.
The Department of Justice kind of stands out when it comes to federal departments in the amount of communication that the president and the president's staff and the department are supposed to have with each other. What kind of barriers in normal circumstances are there supposed to be when it comes to, say, a president or a chief of staff trying to get the Justice Department to investigate anything?
Yeah, and it's a tricky balance because, after all, you know, there's inevitably, I think, some politics to go along with law in the Department of Justice. And a number of these people are, in fact, appointed by the administration, by the president. But nevertheless, over the last few years, particularly after Watergate and the so-called Saturday night massacre that resulted from that, and a number of attempted firings and resignations out of that whole situation, there were a number of barriers that were put up to try to prevent undue political influence from the White House over the Department of Justice. And that includes the sorts of conversations that occurred with one of the key assistant AGs involved in this case, Jeffrey Clark, who had direct contact with President Trump, in part because Trump saw Clark as potentially being much more amenable to these voter fraud claims. And he had those direct conversations with the president that are not supposed to happen at that level. So a lot of the conversations are meant to go through specific channels to try to prevent this sort of undue influence.
And does it stand out more that it's a White House reaching out to a Justice Department in regards to an election that the currently sitting president just lost and asking them to intervene in a way that might tip the scales back in the other direction?
Yeah, absolutely. And when you put it in the broader context of President Trump going to the media and also claiming voter fraud, without evidence and saying that this was an illegitimate election. And when you put these sorts of internal contacts between the White House and the Department of Justice alongside what was going on outside of that context, you know, it raises some real questions about exactly how far Trump and the White House would go to try to overturn an election. or at least interfere with that election. So I think the context is definitely raises the stakes and also raises the concerns about what exactly was going on here.
Talking to Paul Nolet from Marquette University, political scientist there, looking at Senate documents out, an ongoing investigation from the Judiciary Committee, looking at contacts between the president and his staff and the Department of Justice, asking for action to be taken on the 2020 presidential elections. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Now, Paul, Republican members of that committee, notably Senator Grassley from our neighbors, said, what's the big deal? The president floated these ideas. His staff rejected it. A bunch of them threatened to quit if some of these plans moved forward. The president backed off on it. So no problem. What do you think of that that analysis of what we saw there?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, the Republicans are basically saying, look, this isn't a big deal because maybe there were some ideas that were floated here, but nothing happened. You know, at the end of the day, Trump did not fire his acting attorney general, Jeffrey Rosen, like he threatened to do. He didn't fire the U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Georgia. You know, he resigned. He wasn't fired. So all of this, according to the minority report here, the Republicans report, was as much ado about nothing, you know. And I think the portrayal there is to say that President Trump, and before that as candidate Trump and even in his previous career in entertainment, certainly made a lot of claims, but didn't always act on them. And so I think the Republicans are saying, you know, sure, Trump said a lot of stuff here, but there was no overturning of the election and really didn't take action in any sort of, certainly not criminal or inappropriate way. So I think that's what at least the framing of the minority report here was to really emphasize that at the end of the day, you know, nothing did happen. Nothing did come out of this.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jake is with us in DeForest. Jake, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Jake?
I just wanted to comment on, like, you know, I've seen a lot of these quote unquote bombshell reports that come out, and it seems like it doesn't change the political landscape. I mean, his diehard supporters are pretty dug in. They either don't believe the evidence or they don't care. Whatever it takes to win. And his opponents, you know, aren't surprised. I mean, I'm not surprised at all. So,
Jake, thanks for the call. His opponents aren't surprised. His supporters ignored or don't care. Paul, what do you think of that analysis?
Yeah, I mean, I think with these sorts of investigations, you're going to have there's going to be a partisan take on these. And really, even though partisanship is worse now, perhaps, than it has been in the past, this is often the case with investigations. I mean, Watergate was seen as a partisan investigation at the beginning as well. I do think that one of the big things that comes out of this report, and it's important to emphasize that it's an interim report, so there may be still more to come with more investigation and more interviews. But I think it's important to think about how this might set the stage for the future. I mean, after all, a big reason why nothing ended up happening and the Department of Justice didn't go along with this was because many of them threatened to resign if Jeffrey Rosen, the acting AG, was replaced by Jeffrey Clark, who was seen as more of a Trump ally. Now, let's say that you didn't have people who were threatening to resign and instead said, hey, this is a great idea, Mr. President, go ahead with it. Let's carry this out. Then there's a, you know, that could have happened. And we would be in perhaps a different place with all of this. So it's really kind of setting the stage for the next time and wondering about how we might prevent the sort of undue influence we don't want to see the president have over the main instrument of justice in America.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Paul Nolet, associate professor and chair of the political science department at Marquette University. We're talking about the Senate Judiciary Report on Trump administration attempts to overturn the 2020 election results using the Justice Department. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more investigations, hear more testimony from key figures in the Trump administration? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Paul Nolet, associate professor and chair of the political science department at Marquette University. We're looking at Trump administration efforts to overturn the presidential election results leading up to January 6th. Still time for your calls with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls. Troy is with us in Muskego. Troy, hello.
Hello. I think I speak for a lot of people when I say it kind of feels like, you know, if there's any other person, you know, plotting the way Trump was plotting with all these people and what these reports are saying, you know, but because he didn't go through with it, if it's anybody else, that'd be considered like a terrorist attack almost. But just because, you know, like when they bust these guys before they do it or they catch them while they're planning it, it just seems to me like, well, if you wait till they do it, you don't have a you don't have a democracy no more. You don't have a system. That's how Hitler got into power. You know, it just seems to me like any cult leader can basically plot to, you know, overturn an election, overturn like a coup. But unless they actually go through with it, you know, they can get away with it. And then when they do go through with it, that's how you end up with the end of your country.
Troy,
I guess I don't understand why there's no checks on that.
Troy, thanks a lot for the call. And Troy, I think other people do share his concern. Paul, do we have checks for the next effort if a future president, maybe the same president if he's reelected, tries to do something like that again?
Yeah, and I do think that that is the big thing to come out of this report, and something that the report was trying to get across was, what do we do for the next time? And one of the things that they note is that even though there are some barriers, some of those barriers that I mentioned that came out of the Watergate investigation, there to try to put a barrier between the White House and the Department of Justice, you know, those barriers aren't as strong as we might have thought, and maybe they need to be stronger. So one thing that comes out of this interim report is to say, well, even though we're not recommending any criminal charges at this time, at least, we want to make clear that there were inappropriate connections between the White House and the Department of Justice that really need to be addressed, because if this happens again, then maybe you won't have those people to stand in the way and be the barrier between overturning an election. So it's really, in some ways, even though it's recounting what happened on key days like January 3rd, and some of the conversations between the DOJ and White House officials, it's in some ways it's forward looking, saying, hey, we need to strengthen these barriers to undue political influence.
Thanks for the call, Troy, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Margie now in Milwaukee. Margie, hello.
Hi. I think I have a similar comment to the last caller that, you know, if the FBI is investigating some sort of group that's planning a terrorist attempt, they don't have to bomb someplace. If they find it with all, you know, all the trappings of making a bomb and things on their computer and blah, 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 it seems like there's a lot of bomb-making equipment here as far as evidence for what Trump's group was planning. And you take that into consideration with all the other things, like his contact with Georgia and his contact with other states, it's just too much to ignore. I don't understand it. It's very disheartening and downright scary because it was so close to working.
Margie, thanks a lot for the call. You mentioned, Paul, the Senate Judiciary Committee in this report said they're not recommending charges at this time. There are some investigations I know going on at the state level in Georgia. What are the thoughts that someone or more than one person might face legal consequences for these efforts?
Well, I definitely think that it's possible because, after all, there are federal obstruction of justice statutes that do carry criminal liability. There's also this La
longstanding act from 1939 called the Hatch Act that prohibits governmental officials, even if they're appointed and they're, you know, political appointees, it prohibits them from trying to affect and influence elections. And so there may be some criminal liability for those involved here as well. And so this report, this interim report, didn't recommend any criminal charges, but it's certainly not foreclosing those either. And, you know, one point I think on the last callers as well that's important to remember is that, so the key moment in this report was this three-hour meeting between DOJ officials and Trump on January 3rd. Of course, keeping in mind the bigger context, we did have an attack, you know, on the Capitol just 3 days later, January 6th, which is the subject of a separate investigation. But I think one has to keep in mind this full context of what's going on in American politics in the last days of the Trump administration to really get an appreciation of you know, how dangerous some of these moments may have been.
Margie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to political scientist Paul Nolet from Marquette University, looking at a Senate Judiciary Committee investigation, a preliminary report out looking at the ways that former President Trump and his staff tried to influence the Department of Justice to challenge election results in states around the country. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Paul, coming into the morning of January 6th, there were two pieces of big news, the Georgia Senate elections, and then just from a few days earlier, the recording of the then president's call with top Georgia election officials. Did some of the shocking nature of that, those attempts to overturn the election in things like that phone call, get overshadowed and fell out of the limelight because of the obviously shocking events of January 6th?
I think a lot of them did. I mean, the call was really quite shocking. And it also aligns with a number of the findings from this report as well, because even though, you know, that phone call was leaked and got out to the public with Georgia election officials, there were similar conversations happening internally between the White House, like the White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, for instance, and Department of Justice staff, including that the acting AG, Jeffrey Rosen, and others. And I think connecting all of this was this narrative that the White House was trying to push, which was that there is this fraud all over the place and the entire election is illegitimate. And I think President Trump was kind of, you know, using that message in a variety of different venues, some targeted towards Georgia officials, some targeted towards the Department of Justice, some targeted towards his supporters. And I think that's, again, why we need to look at the broader context, because I think in many ways it paints a picture of a president who was not happy that he had just lost the election and was trying every avenue possible to try to stay in power. And that really raises the question of how can we prevent a situation where, you know, unlike this situation, essentially an attempt to overturn the election is successful in the future. How do we prevent that?
Time for one more caller. Tim is with us in Waukesha. Tim, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask Professor Nolet if he thinks actually the failure of political parties in Congress has led to a lot of this rattle and hum that we've experienced. If so, how have they failed?
Interesting, Paul. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think because of the way that partisanship works these days, there's an incentive to essentially never criticize your own party or members of your own party, or at least keep it to a minimum, knowing that, you have to keep the attention always on the other side and saying how horrible the other side is in order to keep, support for your side up. And, you know, thinking back to Watergate in the 1970s, again, that began as sort of a partisan or seemingly partisan investigation, but a number of Republicans eventually came on board as more evidence came out. It seems like in this day and age that it's a lot harder for party members to break out of that. I mean, we saw what happened with Liz Cheney, for instance, who was a critic of Trump and voted for impeachment and such. Now she's pretty much out of the party. altogether. And so I think there's a sort of discipline within the parties that, you know, is in its own way kind of dangerous, because it prevents sort of a, you know, kind of an internal conscience within the parties to check maybe the worst impulses of the partisans within it.
Thanks a lot for that call. Paul, in just our next couple minutes, we have the Senate Judiciary Committee investigation. We have, you mentioned, the House January 6th committee. What are you watching for? What are you most interested in finding out that we don't know at this point from these ongoing investigations?
Well, I think, you know, there's still a lot of missing gaps here. You know, key individuals like Mark Meadows, Jeffrey Clark, they haven't been cooperating with the investigation. And of course, you know, the former President Trump has said, hey, nobody should agree to work with Congress on this. So I am curious. I mean, the big thing is going to be whether anyone does sort of break down, I guess, and say that they're going to work and provide information to Congress, because I think that's a critical part of the data collection effort here, and is really going to be important moving forward as these go together. So that's certainly the big thing I'm looking for, is whether anyone voluntarily works with Congress, or whether, you know, courts start ordering people to comply with subpoenas that Congress is issuing.
Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
All right, thank you.
That's Paul Nolet, Associate Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at Marquette University. He talked to us about the Senate's ongoing investigation of Trump administration efforts to pressure the Justice Department to overturn last year's presidential election results. Coming up, a 14-year-old Wisconsinite is leaving a lot of the older, more experienced competition in the dust at racetracks near and far. We talk with her about her hobby of racing her Midwest Mod race car. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the World Health Organization approved a malaria vaccine for the first time last week. We'll talk to a malaria researcher about the impact it could have and the potential for even more effective vaccines in the future. Now, one Wisconsin 14-year-old has had an unconventional road to learning how to drive. Despite not yet having her license, she's been behind the wheel of a variety of vehicles since she was 3, from go-karts to ATVs to now a Midwest Mod. She's taken many top 10 finishes in this last year, her official rookie year, including a first-place win in the 41st Punky Manor Challenge at Red Cedar Speedway, making her the first female driver and the youngest ever to win that race. Kennedy Swan is a Midwest Modified race car driver from Chippewa Falls. She currently ranks in second place out of 130 rookie Wissota Midwest Mod racers from across the country. I talked to her last week. Kennedy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, how did you first get started racing, you know, racing anything in the first place?
Well, my dad used to race a Midwest Mod and an A Mod. And with that, he put me into go-karts. And then I raced that for, I think, about 8 years. And once I turned 13, I went to a Midwest Mod.
And let's talk about Midwest Mod. For people not familiar with it, what does that mean?
So it's a race car, mm-hmm. A 350 Chevy motor. I have an SSR car. I guess that's really it.
So you've moved from go-karts. You've done, I think, ATVs and other vehicles. What do you like about Midwest Mod driving? Is that more fun than your past experiences?
Yes, it is. I feel like it is a lot more harder to drive, I think, personally, but it's just the way the car is and how fast it'll go and just how it works really interests me, and it really, like, gets me, I have a lot of adrenaline with it.
How fast does it go? What kind of speeds are we talking about here?
Okay, well, the average is probably 70 miles an hour. That's like around average, but it can go more. It can go more, it can go less. It depends what kind of track you're racing at and what, like, if it's hammer down or if it's dry slick. It just depends.
Yeah, and what kind of shapes of tracks are we talking? Circles, ovals, or like kind of a row, a street track? What does it look like?
It's an oval shaped.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. And you said the adrenaline gets going, but in a fun way, right?
Yes.
Was it? I was it, it. It sounds a little scary to me. I don't know. Was it ever? Was there of a point where like, oh, this is kind of scary, or were you just right into it?
Right away, jumping from a go-kart to a Midwest mod was a bit, it was a little bit scary just because it was a lot bigger and a lot more complicated. And I was, when the first time I went out, I was scared I was going to hit someone or something.
Now you aren't old enough to have, a license to go out and drive on a road, but you have a lot of experience driving. Do you remember your first experiences behind a wheel? What was it like that learning curve at a younger age?
Well, my first time behind like a wheel, which is when I was five, I really don't remember much. I
Sure.
remember though, the first time we went to the racetrack, I wouldn't get in my go-kart. I was too scared of it. And so somebody else went out and just to test it, make sure everything's stable and stuff. Well, I got more mad because someone was in my cart. I iced raced then that winter. And I was racing again. I had a 50 four-wheeler going against 90s. And so I took last, and I was very upset that I did not win and that I took last. And so we went ice racing for the year. And then that next summer, then I went to my go-kart, and it was just wide open from there.
Are you generally a pretty competitive person, or is it only in racing? Like, if I played a game of cards with you or something, you'd be pretty competitive.
Yeah, very competitive.
Now, I understand you do some, physical exercise, weightlifting and stuff in order to be able to handle the car. What is your training regimen like?
Okay, well, I've done CrossFit since I was in sixth grade, but I recently stopped in the beginning, well, midsummer, beginning summer, to go to the YMCA to work out on my own and so I can go more hours or more days. I'll usually work out 4 times a week.
You don't just drive the car. I understand you do maintenance on it. What kind of work do you do to keep the car in good shape?
So if I get in a crash, I got a lot of body work, tin work. I do air filters, oil them, clean them, wash down the car, wash tires, nut and bolt, lube and clean. There's a Anything is broken, then we do that. I'll put on tires, clean out the trailer, I'll change oil. So it just depends. Those are the main stuff that we do on a daily basic. But if something gets wrecked or stuff, we'll have to do more.
Now, I think if you said race car driver to somebody, they'd picture, well, one, an adult, and two, probably a guy. What is it like for you being, a 14-year-old girl in the racing world?
It's pretty cool actually. I like being that I'm in a male dominant sport and I'm not the only girl, but I am a girl in it, and there's a lot of other girls, but not as many as men. So it's really cool to see like that I'm doing pretty good and that I'm beating them.
And I understand you are beating people. You're having a pretty successful year as a rookie. How are things going?
Everything's going really good. Last year when I was thinking I wasn't gonna be much better than I was last year, and well, that was not true. And I raced over like 55 shows this year, and I've had a lot of top tens, over 40 of them, and that's just something that I did not think that was gonna happen.
I wonder, you're performing at a high level here. You've got the adrenaline going, making those tough decisions. Do you think this helps you in your non-racing life? Like, does this help you in your daily life?
Yes, I really do. It helps me stay humble to everyone. It helps a lot. It does.
So what is your, I know you're 14. I don't want to have you chart out your full life right here, but what are your thoughts on what your future in racing could look like?
Man, I really don't know. But I really hope that I want people to see me as like, so there's a lot of good drivers out there, and I don't, maybe people consider me as one also, but I want to be like, oh my God, that's Kennedy Swan. I know she's a good driver, and I might be considered that now, but I want my name to get out there even farther, and I want to get even better and improve, and I want to become a really good female race driver.
Kennedy, thanks a lot for talking to me. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Kennedy Swan, a 14-year-old Midwest mod race car driver from Chippewa Falls. She currently ranks in second place out of 130 rookie WSOTA Midwest mod racers from around the country. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an excerpt, from a new book that takes place in a historic hotel.
The Playboy Club Hotel opened in Lake Geneva in 1968. It became a hub for Midwestern travelers, businessmen, and of course, Playboy bunnies. Author Christina Clancy of Madison has just released a novel called Shoulder Season that takes place at the historic resort. She tells the story of fictional 19-year-old Sherry Taylor, who enters a period of self-discovery while working as a bunny. Here's Clancy reading an excerpt from the book. In this scene, Sherry has just begun her job as a bunny, and she learns that the job is a lot different than she imagined.
Sherry began to understand why Gloria, the bunny mother, didn't want to use the word waitress to describe the work the bunnies had to do. What waitress trained for an entire week or stayed up late trying to memorize the contents of two huge binders that were bigger than the Old Testament? Memorization was easier for Sherry than for most of the other girls. She was able to take a mental picture of just about anything she saw and store it in her brain, but still she was overwhelmed by all the rules Bunny Star ticked through. Don't let guests see you wear jewelry, chew gum, eat, or sit. You'll get demerits for having dirt under your nails, if your ears are bent incorrectly, or if you don't keep the changing room cleaned. You need to look at the bulletin board every day for updates and attend bunny council meetings. And don't ever forget to check the ashtrays. Bunny council sounded important. They had their own employee newsletter called the Hare's Head. Wouldn't her friend Jean be impressed to learn that there was more to Sherry's job than strutting around in a bunny suit? Sherry had underlined a line she'd found in the bunny manual twice, once for herself and once for Jean. The bunny has become what the Ziegfeld girl was to another generation, synonymous with the most glamorous young women in the world. She was part of a tradition. She was finally part of something. Sherry even got benefits. She felt like a real adult filling out her forms for accident, life, and health insurance. She had a week's paid vacation and a free subscription to Playboy magazine that she could read 2 weeks before the subscribers. Guests could practically eat for free with Sherry's family discount, but this perk only made Sherry sad that she didn't know anyone who would visit her. Sherry was told she'd be welcome at the Playboy clubs in Chicago and Los Angeles and all over the world. When she heard this, she smiled at Bunny Rhonda. We should go to Chicago. That's okay, Rhonda said. I went there on a school field trip to see the King Tut exhibit. I couldn't stand all the shadows. The shadows? From the skyscrapers. The middle of the day in the city feels like the middle of the night. The L is so loud. I'd be fine if I never went back there again. The loudest thing I hear in Barneveld is a screech owl. That's enough for me. The most important rule, and the one that bothered Sherry the most, was that bunnies were forbidden from dating not just co-workers, but also key holders and guests. The women broke out in a collective groan when they heard this. Now, we're disappointingly moral here, Bunny Star said in a voice that could break up a party. Disappointing was right. Sherry had had a million crushes on the boys at school, and she'd daydreamed about encounters with celebrities like Leif Garrett and Sean Cassidy. Her notebook was filled with the signature combined with the last name of whichever boy she liked at the time. Sherry Parker, Sherry McBride, all with a heart as the dot for the I in Sherry. But aside from Tommy, she'd had little experience. She didn't know how to flirt, much less act sexy. She'd hoped to change all that. Wasn't the resort supposed to be the sexiest place on earth? But with all the rules, she felt like the mystique around Playboy was a total lie. Rhonda seemed relieved, while Sherry felt she'd been betrayed. We may as well have joined a nunnery, she whispered to Bunny Ginger. Don't worry, Ginger winked. I heard there are ways to have fun.
That was author Christina Clancy reading from her new novel, Shoulder Season, which tells the fictionalized tale of working at the once very real Playboy Club Hotel in Lake Geneva. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, the World Health Organization has approved a malaria vaccine for the first time. We'll talk with an expert on the disease about the life-saving impact it could have and the work that still needs to be done. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. The World Health Organization has endorsed a malaria vaccine for the first time. The news about the recommendation came last week, with the WHO's director calling it a historic moment. The approved vaccine has been used in trials for more than 800,000 children over the last 2 years in African countries. While only about 30% effective, it could still have a big impact. Others, like our next guest, are working to develop a better vaccine for the future. Dr. Sean Murphy is an associate professor of laboratory medicine and pathology at the University of Washington. His lab is currently researching malaria vaccines. Dr. Murphy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Nice to meet you.
Before we dig into vaccines, can you talk about the scope of the malaria problem? It doesn't affect us so much here in the Midwest. It's a big deal globally, right?
It's a huge deal globally, and there have been great gains made in the last couple of decades. In the 90s, there was upwards of 3 million deaths a year, and now we're talking maybe about 400,000 deaths a year, which is still a staggering toll, but much improved. Unfortunately, the COVID pandemic worldwide is threatening that progress, and that really drives home why we need a vaccine. I think one thing your listeners might be interested in, though, is that, you know, in the 1930s, we had 1 million cases of malaria a year in the U.S., and since I'm talking to Wisconsin, I even read that in Fort Campbell in the southwest part of Wisconsin, there was a time when upwards of 75% of the troops in the 1800s at that fort would have malaria at any one time.
How do we limit the impact of malaria so much in the United States then?
Well, we have a great deal of infrastructure that a lot of resource poor areas do not. We don't live in the optimal place for these mosquitoes and parasites to live. So, you know, our wonderful, like, Wisconsin and Minnesota winters, et cetera, obviously curb transmission in much of the year. And if you go to equatorial parts of the world, the conditions are perfect. And then we have screens, we have air conditioning, we treat people who have malaria, we drain ditches, we have the Center for Disease Control. We have a lot of efforts underway and have for 100 years to combat things like this. The reason the CDC is in that southeastern part of the U.S. is in large part in response to diseases like malaria, which used to ravage that part of the country even more than elsewhere.
So here we are, 2021, this vaccine, 30% effective. That doesn't sound great, but with the numbers involved, does that put a big dent in our annual malaria toll?
Well, this is kind of interesting one because, you know, we're trying to make another vaccine that's more effective. And, you know, we could look at this and say, gosh, that's not very good. But I heard an interesting statistic, which was that that efficacy is about as good as a bed net. And for the last couple of decades, bed nets have been a very important life-saving measure in Africa. And so, unfortunately, you know, if a bed net is 30% and this is 30%, we don't just get 60% out of that. They're not strictly additive. But because there's so much malaria transmission in the world, we do think, and this is why the WHO endorsed this, that, you know, there could be tens of thousands of lives saved a year. And for that reason, and because, you know, the vaccine is safe and it's even more effective earlier after, you know, giving the vaccine. But just like we've seen with COVID vaccines, we're not walking around with antibodies that are as high as they were right after we were vaccinated. And so those levels fall off, and that's where words like boosters and things like that come into play.
As I understand it, Dr. Murphy, the Plasmodium, the thing that causes malaria, it's not a virus, it's not a bacteria, it's a single-celled parasite. Does its, I don't know, unique nature make it a hard target for vaccines?
Yeah, definitely. There are no approved vaccines, I guess, until last week for any what we call eukaryotic pathogens. So, you know, we humans, we are eukaryotes. We have more complicated DNA genomes than bacteria and viruses. And Plasmodium is in that same class. It's a single-celled eukaryote, and we're obviously made of lots of cells. But because of this, it has over 5,000 genes in its genome, and it makes it that much harder to find a single target that is the Achilles heel of the parasite. This vaccine comes pretty close to doing that, but it's based on antibodies and it protects. But if the parasite gets past that protection, then, you know, some people go on to have malaria even if they were vaccinated. And that's what we would really like to solve down the road. But this vaccine, this approval is a first step.
Talking to Dr. Sean Murphy from the University of Washington about malaria and a new approved vaccine and the future of malaria vaccines. Dr. Murphy, can you talk some about your work? What paths are you pursuing to pursue a hopefully even more effective vaccine for malaria?
Sure. So malaria is transmitted when female Anopheles mosquitoes bite you. And then the parasite goes into your skin for a little bit, just like a few hours perhaps, but then it makes its way to your liver. And after about a week, it comes out and causes the blood stage infection that we know as malaria. That's what everybody says when they're talking about the disease. So the goal is to either prevent the liver from being infected or to kill the infected cells in the liver before they go to the blood. The vaccine that just got approved is intended to stop that early infection of the liver just in that first few hours. And what our group is really interested in is using T cells to hunt down and kill the infected cells. And one of the great things about that is we have the benefit of time. We have maybe 4 or 5 days as opposed to just hours to kill all those cells. The hard part is that the liver is a big place if you're an immune T cell, and you know, you have to surveil the liver. So the goal with our vaccine is actually to create a vaccine that educates T cells about the parasite, but then also tells them to go hang out in the liver. And we call them residents of the liver. And so you could imagine them like as a security force in the liver, and they're patrolling. And if they find an infected cell, they call all their friends, they all get excited, and hopefully they have over 4 or 5 days, enough time to kill off the parasite. We're hopeful that this could potentially provide higher levels of protection than just an antibody-based vaccine. But it's a tall order, and we have a ways to go, but we're making great progress here at the University of Washington.
In our last minute or so, even if we do get a more effective vaccine, do you think this is going to be malaria is going to be a thing that a vaccine alone is going to solve, or is it going to be a combo between vaccines, physical barriers like those bed nets you mentioned, public health infrastructure like you were talking about earlier?
It will very much depend on how effective the vaccine is. The way I've been describing RTSS this week, this is the approved vaccine, is that we now add this to the toolkit alongside bed nets and spraying and treating. If we had a vaccine with really high efficacy, we might be able to turn off some of those other public health interventions. But it will really require that the efficacy be more than 80% or even higher. So time will tell. This is a parasite that's been with us for a very long time, and making a vaccine is a tall order.
And briefly, Dr. Murphy, as I understand it, there are different types of malaria and the parasite that causes it. Are vaccines a one-size-fits-all, or do we need a different vaccine for each one?
Well, we at the moment would need a different vaccine for each one. That's certainly the hope, that one day we could have a pan-plasmodium vaccine. And the same thing people are talking about, gosh, I wish we had a pan-coronavirus vaccine. So those are very much on the wish list, but the first problem is hard. The next problem is even harder. We have a lot of research to do for a while, it sounds like.
Dr. Murphy, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you. Take care.
That's Dr. Sean Murphy, Associate Professor of Laboratory Medicine and Pathology at the University of Washington. He talked to us about the World Health Organization's recommendation of a malaria vaccine for the first time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, people in jail and prison can face unexpected costs when it comes to communicating with the outside world. Find out why and what it means for their ability to re-enter society tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we compare the underwater oil pipeline spill in California with concerns over pipeline stretches here in the Midwest, including in Wisconsin. We'll talk to a reporter covering each of those areas. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.